Hey legends, my name is Mo and welcome to the Can't Can World podcast. I am a Royal Marine who is dedicated to optimizing human performance and want to bring you exposure to the fantastic people supporting the same aim. In this next episode, this person needs no introduction. He is a true inspiration and epitomizes what it takes to be better tomorrow than today. If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast channel for updates on new releases. And why not leave us a review with your podcast provider and follow us on Instagram on the @MoMorrisRM page to show your support.
Right. Can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I've got you. Don't be speaking all posh. Yes, did I can hear you.
Did you have your volume turned down?
No, I didn't actually. I just didn't have the earphones plugged into Zoom. That's all. Gotcha. Standard. It's a very dashing looking man.
Who, me?
Yeah. I'm liking the trim on the beard, mate.
Thank you. I'm trying to keep it tidy this time. Let me just turn this crap off. What's new, mate?
Oh, mate, plate spinning as usual, like you've been doing. I've got loads going on with work and outside with house renovations and all that sort of good stuff. So, and then these podcasts are mint, but I didn't realize the amount of time for editing that, you know, and it's great having the chat. I'd love to be able to just send it to someone and say, mate, can you sort that out, if I had the readies to do it. So that's why the editing's a bit dodgy, but it's good though. I'm learning a lot from them. Really good. Have you been?
Yeah. All right, mate. Just same old, really just busy. Dealing with idiots as normal. Just when I think I've dealt with them all, another couple dive back into the circle to thin them out.
But that's because you're a bit of a big time now. That's why.
Do you know what, right? And you know me, mate. And I say this with all humility, right? But I think that's what people do now. They look and they see shit. And they just look at, oh, I can get something from this guy. And this is what I'm experiencing more and more now, mate. People just, they see something, they offer something, but like these, I won't bore you with it, mate, but these blokes we've just been dealing with, they've come into like the circle with me and Ben and Sam and everyone. And like, I've just found out like behind the scenes, they've been tapping up all of our contacts, all of our networks, doing all this dodgy stuff behind the scenes. They've been down to the Royal Marine shop saying, oh, Mark, so we can have all this free kit, and just rinsing people. And yeah.
Just social leeches, mate.
Epic, mate. Absolute epic. It just, you know what it's like, mate. As bootnecks, I think you get too trusting sometimes, and you let blokes in, and they're just, their ulterior motive is just to manipulate you and get what they can, and then leave you dry.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it is what it is, mate. We've run with them now.
How do you deal with that, though? Because you've had it done to you before. So, how do you deal with that?
Normally, mate, I'm pretty good at it. I got mate through the stage of just being ruthless, but for some reason, I don't know why, this recent one, just, I was raging all weekend. It wasn't until this morning I was able to like calm myself down. Just raging. I think it's because I called more and more people and they were telling me more and more stuff. And I think I felt a bit stupid that I was blind to it. And then I was just raging that someone had the neck to manipulate me that way to try and make money off my back. You know, and I'm making nothing. So I'm just like, how can you be that necky? You know, but people are, mate, when it comes to money.
It's pretty ruthless. And I think you're right. We are a little bit trusting. But having said that, we also have a bit of a ring of steel as well. So yeah, you've got to earn that trust to get in. But yeah, when it comes to business, I suppose it's a different kettle of fish, and you've got to be quite careful about who you select to trust and who you know that you will have your back no matter what, because money makes people do some crazy things, eh?
Yeah, mate. Yeah, absolutely.
Mate, your life is pretty well documented. I mean, you've been on about 1,000 and a million podcasts, even if that's not a number. So I want to just talk about maybe a few different bits about Mark Ormerod than what it would be normally, where people will talk to you about resilience and mindset and all that sort of stuff. And I know that the bottom line to your mindset is that you're just a bit solid and you don't know when to give up. So, you know, there's not much to it. So I don't really want to waste too much. No, joking.
It's pretty accurate, mate. It's pretty really accurate.
I don't really want to sort of like regurgitate that. I'm really interested in Mark Ormerod before the Marines.
Okay.
I'm really interested to know who you haven't changed, but you will be a different person now. But I want to know who the little Jana Scully was before the Royal Marines. So you're Plymouth born and bred, are you?
I am a born and bred Jana, correct. Born in Freedom Fields Hospital, which no longer exists. Grew up around a place called Pennycum Quick. And the funny thing is, throughout my entire childhood, where my bedroom was, as the crow flies, it was about 200 meters from Plymouth train station. So like every day, especially on the weekends, I would wake up to a tannoy. I could hear, you know, the train is ready for platform 3. And then you fast forward to I'm 17. I'm stood on that platform about to go to CTC, looking back at my bedroom, shit in my pants. Like, uh-oh, the tables are turned now. But my childhood was pretty normal, mate. You know, I had a good upbringing. I wasn't hard done by. I didn't face any adversity growing up. I had everything that a kid could ever need. Food in my belly, roof over my head, good friends around me. And I was just a young, energetic, cheeky, typical kid. You know, I was born in the 80s, grew up in the 90s. You know, when the streetlights came on, you went home, unless you had your parents screeching from the doorstep. You could hear them four streets over. You knew it was time to go in. You'd build dens, explore the woods, you know, break into derelict houses and all that kind of stuff, and break into bloke sheds in the allotments, and then all that kind of stuff, what you just did when you're a kid, getting into misdemeanors, nothing serious, just cheeky kids.
I love it. Well, people will listen to that and go, well, I never did that, because I You make it sound like it's normal. Yeah, we just like used to vandalize stuff and break into things, but that's what happens. I remember jumping over school fences, and it was a dare to see how close you could get the caretaker to chase you before you could get away. You know what I mean?
This is before smartphones. That's how we entertained ourselves.
And the thing is, it's fully like Jack. It's bang out of order, because that's someone's livelihood.
I know.
It's like, you know, seeing what the security is like on a building site, and you can, you know, I think that's where, like, if we knew parkour as kids, we'd be absolute ninjas.
Oh my God. Yeah, absolutely.
Incredible. Like,
diving over fences and jumping across rooftops. You know what I mean? It would have been epic. But yeah, honestly, mate, can't complain. You know, nothing to complain about. Had a loving family, great friends, great school life, very average student. Like I said, it's a little bit
below
cheeky.
Average.
Well, below average is being
generous. How did you find school? Did you enjoy it?
I think, like any kid, mate, there were parts I enjoyed and parts I didn't. You know, I didn't like maths, and, you know, science was okay and English was okay. But, you know, you just kind of focus on the things that you enjoy and kind of drift from the things that you don't. But I did all right. You know, I came out of it with 10 GCSEs. 9 of them were A to Cs. I got an A in English. I got 2 A's. I can't remember what it was in. I got a B in drama, C's in science and English. The only D I got was in geography.
Mate, you got an A star in drama now, haven't you?
Absolutely, mate. Look out, Hollywood, here I come. But yeah, I mean, the best thing about, I think, growing up in the 90s, and I'm sure every generation would say this about their childhood, but, you know, I was a massive action movie nerd. Stallone, Schwarzenegger, Seagal, Bloodsport, and Kickboxer. Oh, I just watched them to the VHS cassettes, just went, they're dead. You remember VHSs? You know, you just watch them, you have to rewind them, and I'd rewind them and just watch those special kick scenes again, and, you know, all your favorite scenes again and again and again until the cassette broke. You know, it was pretty much what I'd spend my spare time.
My favorite movie was Commando.
Yeah.
Arnold Schwarzenegger. And yeah. I think my granddad got it for me when I was like 5. It's not the sort of movie that you'd show a 5-year-old.
Right.
And I used to watch that all the time, to the point where my dad would avoid the front room and not come in.
Yeah.
And so my dad was a bit of a breeder. So I think when I was like 25 or something, you know, or my 20s, early 20s, he had another kid.
Mm-hmm.
So I obviously repaid the favor. So I bought it, Billy a DVD of Commando, and I just remember my old man's face when he looked at it. It's like a funny old thing. Yeah, he fell in love with it as well. So,
but I think it's brilliant, right? Because it's not really until I was older, I kind of, and you know, I do personal development and all this kind of stuff and open up to different concepts and everything, that I think I realized that growing up watching that kind of stuff, it gives you a bit of an alter ego. Do you know what I mean? And I think I genuinely think that is what steered me towards the core, was, you know, the muscle men, action Hollywood superstars, because a lot of them played soldiers in movies. They were the tough guys, but they were the gentlemen. You know, I mean, they kick someone's ass, but then pull out a chair for a lady. And you don't know what's happening when you're a kid when you watch these things. But I think it helps to mold your mindset and kind of you feel rapport with those people, even though it's through a screen. And you want to be like them when you grow up. Do you know what I mean? And I'm telling you, like hundreds of these movies, hundreds of them from everyone, all the martial artists, the big muscly guys. I just watch them all the time, every spare minute I had when I wasn't out doing stuff.
Yeah, no, it's an interesting concept. I mean, I suppose the bit that they wouldn't want you to do is running down the street with a machine gun, taking people out for the fun of it.
Well, you just pretend, don't you? You get your plastic machine gun or your stick.
Did you ever used to have those, the plastic ones that had the trigger that used to make the noise, but and your finger used to get tired when you was constantly pulling it? It had like the machine gun noise to it.
Yeah, and the little flashing light, if you were super rich like me.
And then if you were really inventive, you could attack people with peg guns.
Those were the nuts. If you could engineer a peg gun, then you were like Commando.
Mate, that spring in the old school wooden pegs, they're not made like they used to be. But they were hurtful. When you used to put a decent rubber band on, you used to get like really technical about what rubber bands that you'd use on the, and, you know, optimal stretch for maximum input, impact.
Your best mate was the postman, and you'd collect rubber bands off him and just build your peg gun collection.
So do you think that sort of sense of adventure was a reason why, that alter ego was a reason why that you know, the Royal Marines appealed to you?
I think so, because when I got to a certain age, like maybe 15, you know, and you're coming towards the end of school and you start thinking about what you want to do, I just couldn't imagine myself doing like a normal job. You know, when I sat there and, you know, in my room, just trying to figure out what I want to do in my life, I'd sit there and go, okay, could I be a lawyer? Can I spend my life in a suit doing paperwork? And that didn't excite me. You know, could I work in Tesco's and work my way up the ladder and do something in that area? That didn't excite me. But the thought of wearing a uniform and, you know, I think the biggest thing was the personal development aspect of it, of seeing, am I good enough, fit enough, smart enough, professional enough to actually do that job? You know, and I knew it would be a massive challenge, but then I could see myself doing that job for as long as I could, you know, and it was a completely different feeling when I sat and thought about it. And when I went to the career center and the sergeant major put the VHS recruiting cassette into that, you know, TV video combi thing, that was it. You know, when I saw that, I'm like, that's what I need to do. Because to that point, it was all just Hollywood movies to me. And then when I saw lads fast roping into raiding craft and assaulting beaches and skiing in Norway, I was like, okay, these people actually exist. All right, these guys play them in Hollywood on the screen, but they're actually, you know, they do this job. I was about 15 and a half when I went and saw that. And that was it, mate. I'm just like, that's what I want to do for the rest of my life, if I can.
So do you pass out first time? How did you find in training?
Oh, mate, it sucked. I was 17. Excuse me. I was 17 when I joined, February 2001.
That's young, mate.
Yeah, I was an original. I managed to get through in one hit. And it was, I think, a combination of stubbornness and a lot of luck. You know, I wouldn't say I was like a superb soldier. I'd scrape through most things, but I'd make it, you know, and then I would just, it just felt like a never-ending sludge through treacle. You know, it was never like I was sprinting or never like I was really in the back. It was just, I just have to keep going, just keep going, just keep going. Just and until eventually, you know, it was done. And, you know, October that year, 4 weeks after 9/11, I passed out, you know, original member of 804 Troop.
804, yeah. So on the stroke then. Nice. I was 821. Nice.
Okay.
Mate, it's an interesting concept that you brought up there about the constantly felt like running in treacle, because we do a lot of work in resilience and understanding what resilience looks like. It's a word that's banded around quite a lot. And, you know, we're trying to look at marine training and find out like how it builds resilience. And I suppose the piece of the puzzle is it's not just about bouncing back from adversity, or even some people's definition would be preventing the adversity from happening in the first place. But the bit that you didn't mention, but you did in your comment that I picked out, is that it's the sense of purpose at the end, the goal.
Mm-hmm.
So to be resilient and have no goal is a lot harder than if you had a goal to achieve that resilience.
Yeah, because if you don't have a goal, then what are you being resilient for? You know, that's what I think, what a lot of people's mindsets are. And, you know, I think the answer is life. If you don't have a goal, you have to be resilient for life, because you're going to come up against all sorts of shit, like constantly from different areas of your life, family, work, maybe sport, whatever it is you're into, hobby. You're going to just get knocked down all the time. If you've got a goal, I think it's easier to pick yourself back up. Because you just think about, you know, why am I doing this? What am I doing it for? All right, pity party's over. You know, let's crack on. But there are a lot of people in life, I think, who don't necessarily have goals. You know, they're just cracking on through life and they're happy to do the 9 to 5 and do this, that and the other, because their life's about more than work. It's about more than careers, about more than money. They're just living. And then something tragic happens and it knocks them off. And they find it harder, I think, to get back on track, because they're like, well, I don't really have anything to get back on track for. I'm not driven in the way that some people are. And so they struggle. But I think, you know, my ultimate goal in life is to become the ultimate version of myself. And you can never reach that goal. It's impossible, because every time you level up, you go to the next level and you look for the next level and the next level. So I think that helps with resilience as well. Because you just think, okay, you look at things differently. You get knocked back and you get to a point, I think, where it's actually quite exciting, because you know that the routine, and that happens. You know, life gets hard, you struggle, you get knocked back, because and you know 5 minutes later you're going to have leveled up. And it's a hard cycle to go through. But I think when you recognize it, you know, you do get to a point where you're like, I'm struggling here. Actually, this is a good thing, because I know this is part of the process. I've been through it a million times before. I've just got to, like we said, go through the treacle, way through the treacle, and then I'll come out the other side in a bit and I'll have leveled up, you know? Definitely mindset.
I think that I'd go one further to say, you know, when you mentioned about people that they're living and then when they get knocked back, it's hard, they find it hard to get back up. I think it's one further. I think a lot of people just exist. They don't realize me, living is about taking the opportunity and seeing what's about and exploring and moving forward. That's my take on it. I just think some people, and it's not a bad thing, I'm not saying it's bad, but when you're looking at resilience and trying to overcome adversity, if you're used to just existing on a sort of direction that is fairly non-eventful and stuff happens.
Yeah.
Significant stuff happens. There is no precedence or experience to draw from, like you've got, for instance, or other people have that have had adversity or been in, you know, put themselves out there on their comfort zone to level up, as you call it. I think people are just knocked over and bowled for six.
Yeah, and I'm gonna feel a bit bad saying this, but. Like, I think it's easy to do that in this day and age, because we live in like the easiest time ever, where, you know, where you can run a business from your smartphone and you can call a taxi straight to your house from a phone or order your food to your door. Everything's done for you. Everything's so easy now that that's great, it's progress, but that has a knock-on effect to people's resiliency. You know, like when you used to have to walk, you used to walk around all weekend, you know, 10, 15 miles as a kid, and however far it was to the shop, your grandparents would go down to the shop and have to walk a couple of miles, and people don't do that anymore. You know what I mean? They're not building any, you know, resilience or fitness to resilience, that kind of stuff. Everything's very easy nowadays. It's just given to you and handed on a plate. So I think most people are like, I don't really need to, because I can just get stuff given to me.
Yeah, it's the instant gratification, isn't it? You order on Amazon, it's there the next day. And if it's delayed a day, then you have a meltdown. Like you're angry about it because it's not turned up when you needed it yesterday, you know, or when you wanted it, not needed it, should I say. Now, everything is like, I want something on pay-per-view, bomb, 2 minutes later, it's done. I want a taxi straight to your door off your phone. You literally only have to lift a finger to do that, you know? It's an interesting concept. Mate, I wanna sort of set the context as well about the reasons why you started your journey of where you are today. Your life's been a journey. It's taken various, you know, turns and ups and downs, but it's probably, I really want to talk about the down, specifically, because that will set the context for the next sort of direction I'd like this conversation to go. So can you explain the situation around your time in Afghanistan and then what happened? I know you've spun this dip, you know, this story like millions of times, but for any people that are listening to this that might be new to you, I think it's good context, because then it'll put into perspective what we'll talk about as we move forward.
Okay. So I left the Corps originally in 2006 after doing my minimum 5 years after my first daughter was born. You know, I was only, I think, 21, 22 at the time. So mega young to start a new career. I had a family, a house, responsibilities. But I failed massively as a civilian, like extraordinarily. You know, I mean, I retrained as a bodyguard out in South Africa. Thought I could come back and have this extravagant, well-paid career where I was going to travel the world with celebrities that would treat me really nicely and I'd earn loads of money. That wasn't the reality of the world that I was in. I had a relationship breakdown. I ended up sleeping on my friend's sofa. I was working as a nightclub doorman just as they were regulating the industry, bringing licenses in, and nearly ended up going to prison. So I rejoined the Marines in early 2007 and went to 40 Commando straight onto pre-deployment training, ready for a six-month tour of Afghan on Herrick 7, which was quite exciting because, you know, my life was at a point where I really felt like getting away would have been beneficial, where I could just leave the stresses of day-to-day life behind, go and reprioritize, go do a tour, come back and start again, start fresh. So I went to 40 Commando, got stuck into the pre-deployment training, deployed to Afghanistan on the 7th of September, 2007. And halfway through the tour on Christmas Eve of that year, I was out on a routine foot patrol and on the way back into camp, a place called Forward Operating Base Robinson that we're working out of, I stood on and detonated an improvised explosive device, which tore off both of my legs, eventually above the knee, and my right arm above the elbow, and made me the UK's first triple amputee from the conflict. So that's the short version.
What happened? Can you remember? I asked JJ this when he had a bit of a shocker as well. What was your memories of that situation directly after it happened? Can you remember much?
Whenever I tell this story, I try and tell people you have to kind of imagine, right? Because it sounds very matter of fact, like I just went through a process and things were fine. But it's like everything outside you goes into slow motion, but everything inside goes at 1,000 miles an hour, like thoughts. So when I describe it, what to me is like 2 seconds of the incident. It sounds almost like I'm talking about 5 minutes, but you know, after this device exploded and I realized that we weren't under attack and that I just had an IED, my very first feeling was, the very first one was embarrassment and anger, because we'd had these conversations prior to this happening that you'd have to be pretty stupid to stand on an IED, because the ground's like, well, you know, mate, it's hard, compact sand. It's not sand you get at a beach. So anyone that's been digging in there, it would be very easy to see. But I think where I detonated this device in like this bowl in the ground where it had been raining prior to it, it smoothed all the surface over so you couldn't see it. But I immediately, when I realized what I'd done, was angry. Like, you're the knobhead that's stood on the IED. And then you feel guilt because you put your section in danger. And I kind of knew how, I didn't know what it was I'd stood on at that point, but I knew the kind of theory behind anti-personnel mines. You know, it's designed to maim you, not kill you. Then when all your opals come in to try and save your life and evacuate you, then all the lads pop over the hill with AKs and wipe the whole section out. So all that's running through my mind is all my section are going to get killed now because the Taliban are going to pop over the mountain with AK-47s and take out my section. So then I feel this massive wave of guilt. Then, and this is like second number 5 or 6 now, then I think straight back to my daughter and I'm like, if I survive this, is she going to want a relationship with me? Because we didn't really have one back then anyway, because we had I had a messy breakup with her mum. And if I made it back and I'm this, you know, freak in a wheelchair, if I pick her up from school, is she going to get bullied? Is she going to have kids giving her a hard time when she's growing up? And if she does, that's going to be my fault. And all this is in like 5 or 6 seconds. And everyone thinks that you're worried about your life and you're scared you're going to die. But I never thought I was going to die because of the men that were around me. But those thoughts that I had made me want to die. So the section commander, Corporal Halesby, he's a guy I went through training with back in 2001. He was on the patrol with us. And I'd known him for a long time, longer than anyone else in the section. And so I just told him to shoot me. You know, I took my helmet off. He was stood behind me and I threw it over. And I was like, Sean, just shoot me. I'm not going home like this. I don't want to do this. And I closed my eyes. And I just literally imagined it would be like getting punched in the back of the head. And then I'd just black out and not wake up. And all that was just because I felt angry and ashamed and embarrassed and stupid about standing on IED. And the ripple effect that it would have on my section, my family, my friends, and everyone around, you know? And I didn't want that. So I just thought, this is a honorable way for me to die. You know, I was in no pain at the time, but I knew it was coming. So I thought, if he just caps me now, this is the quickest and easiest way for me to get out of this situation. And hopefully then, if I'm kind of, because you know what it's like in those situations, as chaotic as everything is and as graphic and realistic as it is, lads are literally ticking boxes in their head as they go. So I'm like, right, if I'm dead, that's a box tick. They can crack on, evacuate, tactical withdrawal, get somewhere safe, foot off the enemy, get other people home safe, you know? And people find that difficult when I say that. They don't think that's, you think you're going to be there going, oh, save me, and scared you're going to die. I didn't think about it really at all. I never thought I was going to die.
Yeah, the lads will, you're trained to, in that situation, that's when the training, like, it sounds cliche, but it does kick in because, mm-hmm. And you're right, it is absolutely process driven, whereby something happens, you react, and it's all to do with the process. You follow the process. Mm-hmm. You follow what you've been trained to do to get out of that situation. And that's where then emotion starts coming into it, where lads might like cry or they might, you know, be angry or whatever it might be. But it's actually this, it might be panic initially, but when they mm-hmm. assess the situation, they're in like, I'm going to sort this out mode, mm-hmm. which is really odd to see in a really shit environment like that.
in a
situation that you found yourself in. But that's arguably one of the reasons why you felt that you weren't going to die, because you knew the lads were going to square you away.
And they did.
They did.
Like, and you know, I always try and give credit to them for this, because I don't know if the situation is reversed, if I would have been as cool and as collected and as professional as they were, you never know. But I think 9 times out of 10, when you run these drills in training, you'll cock them up. Someone at least that somewhere along the line will cock it up. But when you have to do it and someone's life is at stake, lads just operate on a different level. And like minutia is just like, I'm not even bothered with that. It's just go, go, go. I made a mistake. Don't care. I'll keep drilling. Keep and just keep doing it. No one's arguing, panicking, telling you you're doing it wrong. Everyone's just doing what they can in the moment as best as they can. And to a degree, you know, and I mean this totally respectfully, to a degree, cuffing it as they go, you know, because you have to. You can go through the drills and the procedures, but it's not always going to go right. And they just say, right, okay, that's wrong. Don't worry, crack on. And they did it, you know, and got me out of there, you know, a pretty difficult situation that I was in like a 12-foot crater up on high ground. They managed to get me out quick, Kazivat me and get me to a helo.
And it's that sort of mentality is the reason why I think the lads do quite well when they leave the service. It's almost mm-hmm. like, I'm just going to do it anyway. I don't care. I might well fail. I'm just going to get on and do it anyway. And it's that which goes back to what you were saying before about, you know, perseverance and resilience, etc., where you have to experience that to level up. And in those little micro moments, the lads are leveling up because they just got to get the job done. Mm-hmm. They might trip when they're running in that environment. They get up, no one says anything. It's just, and the next time they won't. And it, you know, small little micro actions collectively make a huge impact on the result.
Absolutely, mate. Yep.
So when you got back to the UK, so just sort of quickly explain, you've flown out on Hilo.
Yeah, Chinook from Fob Rob back to Camp Bastion and then a plane back home to Selly Oak Hospital in Birmingham about 4 o'clock in the morning on Christmas Day, where I spent, I think it was 3 days in a coma, like a drug-induced coma, and very briefly brought back to consciousness on the 28th of December as they reduced the medication just to see if I was able to wake up. And then that week was on intensive care, you know, gradually bringing me out more and more into the real world, reducing the medication and giving me the opportunity to understand and try and accept what had happened.
You know, I don't want to, you know, it's a really big moment in your life, but I know it's also well documented, as I said before, mm-hmm. and I didn't want to go over that again and again, but I think we needed to, you could spend a whole show just talking about that specifically, because it is fascinating to listen to. The recovery piece for you, when you said that you were going over to try and understand and deal with what was going on, how did that happen? Like, what did you, like, I know it was loads to take in, but how did you, do you remember what the processing sequence was and how you felt, and what sort of moments in time do you remember sort of being okay with having one arm? Are you okay with having one arm? Like, you know, what's that journey been like?
Do you know what, right? I don't know if it was, I'm going to say it was a mix. In intensive care, it was a mix of highly trained professional people and luck. And what I mean is, I only spent a week in intensive care. A lot of that time was spent hallucinating because of the pain meds. So when I woke up, I thought I had both my feet missing and some fingers on my right hand, you know? And so you kind of like, you're in this spaced out zone on like day 3 or 4 and you don't really care because of the medication. You're like, yeah, okay, cool. And then as they gradually reduced me off the pain medication, literally to perfection, I started to realize day by day the extent of my injuries. So I remember when I realized that both my legs were missing above the knee, and I had this moment of panic in case my nuts had been blown off, and my left hand had a huge hole in it from a shrapnel wound. I could only use 2 fingers and I couldn't reach down to check and scratch. And I wasn't sure what was happening in my right arm. I thought I still had fingers and everything, but anyway, I had to get my dad to check and have a little grab and make sure we were all right, and we were. And I remember feeling the sense of relief I got from that.
And then probably you might want to rephrase that, mate.
I meant, yeah, you know what I mean. You know what
you're
I mean.
You from Cornwall, eh?
Close. But I remember on like day six. So now I know I'm still all right down there. I know what's going on with my legs. And this is the power of the mind, I think. Right up to that point, if I had like an itch on my chest, because I was right hand dominant, I would scratch it with my right hand. But I didn't have one, right? Because I'm amputated above the elbow. And I remember one day I pulled it out from under the duvet on the hospital bed to scratch myself. And I started laughing. And I'm still pretty high at this point. And the nurse is like, what are you laughing at, Mark? And we'd had these conversations to this point about my hallucinations with Will Smith visiting me and ketchup bottles and stuff. And I said, oh, I'm hallucinating again. It looks like my arm's falling off. And she just looked at me with that look as if to say, how am I going to tell him this? And she didn't even have to tell me, man. I knew. But the way that I was weaned off the medication in that short space of time, it was almost perfect. It was like, okay, I can accept that now because I've done the leg thing. I've done the nuts thing. Now I've done the arm thing. And then after 7 days...
Is there anything else that you want to tell me?
No. Yeah, anything else missing? But yes, I only did 7 days in ITU and then went up to the Burns and Plastics ward where they really took me off the pain meds, brought me back to where I was a lot more compos mentis and could really understand what was going on and then try and formulate a plan to move forward.
I mean, that sounds fairly clean cut, but you know, was there a grieving process in there? You know, at points, or do you dwell on what?
Not in that first week. No, in that first week, I think I was too high to really care. Do you know what I mean? Everything was wonderful in that first week. You just don't care about anything. I don't know what I was on, you know, what mixture they had me on, but it worked. And then it was when I got upstairs and I was really brought back into land of living that it became a little bit more difficult. So initially I was kind of like, okay, right, we're going to do this, we're going to do that, blah, 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 blah. And I found out years later that my medical team thought I was suffering from something called post-traumatic euphoria, which is when someone goes through a traumatic incident and they just focus on, I'm going to climb Everest and I'm going to sprint around the world and I'm going to do a handstand for 1,000 miles. And everyone around them is, I think they're trained to like manage your expectations and wait for the crash. But they said with me, the crash never really came. You know, I was just like ready to go from day one. It did come for me. You know, I got like 3.5 weeks in and the medical expert came in and said, you're done. You're 24 years old. You never walk again because prosthetics are too hard for you to use. Then about 6 days later, I met a double above knee amputee called Mick Brennan, who came to visit me in hospital. And then I'm back up again. And then for some reason, when I left the hospital the first time and saw myself in a full length mirror and I couldn't get into certain rooms in a wheelchair in the welfare flat, I was down again. And then I got a visit from a former core RSM, Baz Dorr, and the CEO at the time. And that was something that changed my mindset and my attitude a lot. And I'll spin you the quick dip, right? So back in 2003, I think it was, when I was at Stonehouse Barracks, and Baz Dorr was the RSM of the unit before he was the core RSM. And I was getting charged for, I think it was for fighting or something, I'm sure. And I marched in his office and I'd cut the lining out my lid. And he knew, like just looking at it, that, and it was his pet hate. So he made me take my lid off. He said, you got an hour, go downtown.
Lids for beret, just for those that don't understand.
Sorry, yeah. He said, you got an hour, go downtown, get a new beret, come back to me. And he pinned it to his notice board next to like 5 other ones. So I run downtown, yours go to the tailors.
Yours was about that big as well, wasn't it?
That's what I'm going to say. Well, I do have a 63 size head, but when you come back with this new beret that's not even been shaped, it was like a landing strip on my head and I just looked ridiculous. But you got to bear in mind, but I'm 2 years in the core. I'm a nobody. This is the unit RSM. Right? I'm a nobody to this guy, just some idiot that messed up and he's just charged. When he came to visit me in hospital and he was a core RSM, he brought me a green lid and he said, I remember taking your lid off you and pinning it to the board. And that just knocked me. I'm like, how can a man of this caliber remember a scrote bag like me from back in the day, 2 years into my career? And it really had an effect on me. And I started thinking about the core and our values and what we're about. And then I started thinking about core history. You know, I think we were 347 years old at the time. And I'm lying in the hospital bed. I've got nothing else to do but think. And I remember thinking to myself, there's nobody that I've ever read about, heard about, seen in a museum or anywhere, you know, that has been a member of the Royal Marines that let the side down, that just rapped and quit. And you know what I mean? And I thought, well, I'm not going to be that guy. You know what I mean? There's a spotlight shone on me now because you're the UK's first triple amputee. And there's all these people around watching you and they're expecting you to just, and there's nothing wrong with that, but they're expecting you to go, I'm going to spend my life in a wheelchair. Do you know what I mean? And I was like, I'm not doing that. There's no way I'm doing that. Like, no one before me that I know of has done that. So I'm not going to let the side down. And it changed my mindset. And then from there on, I was like, I've still got the same values that I had 4 weeks ago when I had legs and both my arms. I don't have both my legs and both my arms, but I still have those values and those morals. So I'm just going to carry them into my rehab, you know? And you know what it's like when you're in a tri-service environment as well. I don't know if everyone's like this, but as a bootneck, I always felt, not the pressure, that's the wrong word, but the responsibility to uphold those values and morals in front of other members of the armed forces. And I was going to rehab and I was surrounded by them, you know, and I was the worst injured guy there. And I thought, I'm not going to just crawl through rehab and you know, try and do it. I'm going to dominate it. And so that's the attitude I went in with.
I found working with, you know, lads that have had some shockers, that the global stuff is all great. So, you know, when you're around people and everyone's having a laugh and the jokes are flying and everyone's happy, everyone seems happy. But it was understanding the small things that were the moments that would get to blokes, get to the guys. Mm-hmm. It wasn't, you know, standing, you know, you've been to Invictus Games and been, you know, been amazing, and what you've done in terms of that competition, and this, you know, I can reel off a whole host of other stuff, and everyone goes, oh, Mark's amazing, he's this, he's that, and it is. I'm not paying lip service to that, but the small things are the bits that people don't see, and the bits that happen and things that happen at home invariably when the doors are shut and the curtains are closed in the privacy of your own home. Have you got any examples of things that surprised you that would get to you? And do they still get to you now?
Do you mean about like physically from recovering or mentally from recovering?
Just so I know, Rosie used to get down because he couldn't hold a, you know, lost fingers on his left hand. He couldn't mm-hmm. hold a nail to put bang a nail in to put a picture of his kids on the wall. And oh, okay. That used to make him feel like worthless because he couldn't do something as simple as that. But he'd go and run 100 meters in front of people, you know, partially sighted. And do you see what I mean?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah. Do you know what? I mean, I'm sure there are. I can't think of anything off the top of my head. But I always just looked at it as like almost like a challenge, as in how, I'm not afraid to ask for help. Maybe that's what a lot of people struggle with. I'm not afraid. Do you know what I mean? And I'll say, if I need help with something, I'll ask for it. And I almost looked at it in a way, I guess, if you like delegating. I'm like, okay, right. I need this done. Can you help me with that, please? And I'll get, you know, if I needed to put a nail in the wall, I'd outsource it. Do you know what I mean? And that's not being lazy. To me, that's not something I was used to doing. So it was almost like I'm growing as a person by doing this. And that's the way I'd look at things, you know? And then being an amputee, there are a lot of tools, you know, like prosthetic arms, prosthetic legs for different situations. So, you know, like John White, when he gets home from a long day of training or work or university, he'll put his stubby legs on almost like you would put a pair of slippers on, you know, and just cut about his house on stubbies because he understands that they're a tool and they give him the best quality of life.
They're prosthetics with a short fixed stump, yes. Aren't they?
Yeah. So they're a lot more stable. You're about 4 foot tall. You know, you look a little bit funny, but they're functional, you know, and they're useful and they give you that better quality of life. It's much better as a triple amputee to use them than to be in a wheelchair. And it's sometimes it's just quite exciting trying to figure all these things out and overcome the obstacles, you know. And I'm not just talking about physically, like, you know, what do I do for a career? You know, how do I interact with my kids and take them to the beach? all these kind of things every day. It's like, not so much now, but back in the beginning, it was all a struggle, and it did get quite overwhelming. And I don't just say this, you know, because there's a load of people listening, but you know, the support I got from the core in the beginning was phenomenal. Like, I never needed anything. My family never needed anything. You know, anything that we were struggling with, we just asked and we would get it. And that took a massive weight off. And that made me be able to focus on the things that were a bit of a challenge, you know? So having a good support system around you, especially in the beginning, is critical.
Yeah, no, that's fair, mate. I mean, you've been involved in like ridiculously stupid amounts of harebrained schemes and successful avenues that you've gone down. Recently, even today, read a Facebook post that you mentioned about your entrepreneurship, which is something that you don't really talk about enough and that you're going to start doing, because as you rightly said, people often see you as you synonymous with charity.
Yeah.
So can you just explain a little bit about your entrepreneurial skills and how that's come about and what you're involved with at the moment?
So some of it's come about by having my pants pulled down. So for example, you know, back when I first got injured, I was asked to go and give a talk at a charity event. No, I didn't want to. This was back when I was much younger. And you know what it's like when you first start standing up in front of audiences, particularly military ones, you know, and you know you're going to get a bit of banter. You get really nervous, and I didn't really want to do it. But in the end, it was for a charity, so I thought, okay, I'll square away. So at the end of it, someone came over and said, oh, you did all right there, Mark, didn't you? And I thought they meant I spoke well. So I said, oh, thank you, mate. I appreciate that. He went, yeah, £1,500 for half an hour on stage is pretty decent. And I'm like, who got £1,500? He went, you did. So I didn't get a penny. He went, well, so-and-so that sorted this out for you charged them £1,500. I'm like, oh, really? Did he? So went and took this gentleman to the side and had a word. And I mean, his attitude was like, kind of like, well, that's how the world works, mate, isn't it? I'm like, what? So I get injured. I lose three limbs. I do all the work. You make one phone call. You get £1,500 a month's wages for me at the time. And I get nothing. I said, that's not how it works. And it helped me to change, I think, my attitude a little bit towards, you know, it's okay. I mean, that's a ridiculous amount of money, right? To earn for 30 minutes. That was my month's wage at the time. And my headspace was like, there's no way. But it opened my mind up massively. And so even though it was a bad situation, it was good for me because I learned from it. And that's, you know, this is like 8 years ago. So this is where the whole entrepreneurial thing came from. And, you know, not only did I realize that I could make money speaking, I can make a lot of money. And at the same time, you know, I'm reading all these personal development books and listening to lots of podcasts, because for most of the time I'm lying in a hospital bed if I'm not doing rehab and stuff. So I'm trying to educate myself. I've only got one hand, so I couldn't do the Xboxes or anything else that the lads were doing. So we started writing my first book when I was in rehab. And then as I was reading all these other books from people like Robert Kiyosaki, Tony Robbins, Jim Rowan, all these personal development gurus, I'd never really heard of them before. I kind of stumbled onto it. I started learning about all these things and it just snowballed behind the scenes. Like, so I'll give you an example. When I was working for the Royal Marines charity, for about 8 years of me working from, I was saving about 70% of my wages. And then I just piled it into properties. I started buying really quietly, not making a big deal about it. No one really knew. And I was buying a house here, a flat there, an apartment over there, another house here. Started doing all this stuff at the same time doing the speaking, you know, and I'm earning a decent wage from there. And I mean, now, mate, I mean, some of it's ridiculous. Like, and I'm a nobody in that world. Some people are earning six figures all day long just for an hour keynote. And it just kept on growing there. And then other things were coming along and I'm like, oh, I can make money from doing that, can't I? And the reason I haven't talked about it for so long is because it still feels uncomfortable even to get paid for some of this stuff. Do you know what I mean? Like the other day I was, you know, working on a film set. I can't say a massive amount about it. I'm not big time in it, but I was.
Oh, you are though, aren't you?
I am a little bit. I'm not going to drop any names or anything, but I was mentoring an able-bodied actor who's playing a triple amputee, and I was getting paid to do it. And I'm like, are you serious? And they're like, yeah. And mate, again, what I got paid for 4 days' work, you know, in old school money back when I was serving, it's ridiculous, mate. And I've almost felt guilty for a long time. That's why I've kept it all quiet. I just felt guilty, like, that people would pay me that much money to do some of this stuff, which really, if I was still in the core, I'd do for nothing anyway. And most of the people that I know would do it all for nothing. But then when you see people like this guy taking the money from me doing the talk, and I've literally just had another experience last week where I've been burned, and I've been burned 4 or 5 times in the past with business ventures, because there's a lot of people that all they care about is money. And while at the time it made me very angry because they've, I think, violated my values, I've learned from it. And now I feel a lot more comfortable with these conversations and not bragging, but just being more open with, yeah, okay, I bought my 500th property or whatever, and I got paid this much for doing this thing. I don't, if people ask, I'll tell them that. I won't get embarrassed and hide it from them.
Yeah, I think it's probably because of the world that we come from. You try and stay humble and you feel that that is not being humble, but actually right. there's probably an element to that. It's just confidence. Mm. And it is, in terms of your professional career, is success like that is a measure, that is a measure of what you'd view as professional success, is
right.
is your financial wealth. Mm-hmm. It's not the only measure of success, clearly, but you know, it's I agree with you. I don't think that you should be embarrassed by it, because you've earned every single moment and every right to be in the position that you're in now. No one's given you anything. You know, like, you've had to graft to get where you need to go.
And this is, I was literally speaking to Becky, my wife, on the weekend about this. And I'm like, even if I do start to be a bit more open about this, I'm going to get people saying, oh, you were lucky, or you were handed it. Or I actually went through a phase where, because I do so much with charity, that people start pointing the finger and accusing me of things, right? But she's seen for the last decade plus, I don't remember the last time my alarm didn't go off at 5:30 in the morning. And you know, I spent about 3 years driving to London and back, Plymouth to London in a day for work. And I've traveled all around the world, man. Not only for me, but then I sound like a bit of a martyr now, but like all the schools I've spoken at for nothing, giving up my time for free, charity, you know. And if you saw my DMs, mate, and my emails from strangers that I get on a daily basis, the time and effort that just goes into replying, I don't just delete and mug people off. If I read it and I think that I can help them, I will. And now that's free, unpaid, you know, just because it's the right thing to do. So, and I'm kind of now toughening myself up to the comments and the haters, you know, increasing, going, oh yeah, you're lucky, you did this and you did that. It's only because of that bloke that you had success.
But you know? Mate, I think a lot of that's driven by jealousy as well. And
it is.
You know, and people's own insecurities, because everyone's got a story. Everyone understands what their own story is, but no one really takes the time to understand what someone else's story is.
Mm-hmm.
But I have a question for you, a bit random. Knowing what you know now and in your position that you are now, going back to when you were in Afghan, if you could step left or right and you could walk past that IED, would you do that or would you still step on it?
I don't know, mate. I think it's a very, very difficult question to answer. Because, so when I rejoined the Corps, my first 5 years, I was just young and crazy, and like any young Marine is, right? And especially back in our time when there was a big drinking culture and it was all about runs ashores and all that kind of stuff. But when I rejoined, I actually had a plan, like a career plan, and I knew what I wanted to do. And I think had this not happened, I like to think it would have went the way I wanted it to go, but my life would be completely different right now, you know? And my life is good now. Like, it's been a struggle, but so is anybody's life. And it's at a place now where it's good. And if I dropped off the planet tomorrow, my family are squared away. Do you know what I mean? So I'm only 37, but I'm in that kind of legacy area of my life, if you like. Do you know what I mean? Where I'm happy with the way things have gone. And it's exciting because I'm only 37. And, you know, when I think about what's coming and what I'm working towards, you know, I don't think any of this would have happened had I not been injured. You know,
I asked that question because I asked two other people, Spiderweb, who was another Royal Marine triple amputee, and Joe Townsend, who was a Royal Marine double amputee. And I asked Spider and I said to him exactly the same question. And he dead straight in the eye, he said, absolutely, I'd take it back. And I would have, you know, stepped left of that.
Oh, really?
That question. I asked Joe Townsend that question. And Joe Townsend said to me, no. I said, I'm a Paralympian. I've got an incredible life now. And had I not done that, I would have, in his mind's eye, he would have just been a normal person. He said, and the experiences and the things that I've got to do, albeit it's been more difficult, I wouldn't change anything that's happened to me. I would keep it exactly the same. And I was like, wow, that it surprised me. But then, because I asked him, then I asked Spider expecting the same answer, but he was completely different. Hence the reason why I'm asking your opinion as well on you, you know?
Yeah, I mean, we've all taken different paths, mate. And you know some of the cool stuff I get to do. And I agree with Joe in that I don't think I'd do any of it had this not happened, because I'd just be another extremely good-looking Royal Marine rocking around doing my thing. You know what I mean? Another face in the crowd.
Mate, I'm going to edit that bit out. I'm editing that bit out. It nearly made me vomit in my own mouth. It's disgusting.
Oh.
Mate, let's talk jiu-jitsu, because I think it's a really fascinating environment that you're in, because most people that know anything about jiu-jitsu would see the fact that in jiu-jitsu, you lock arms, you lock legs, you use them as levers, you know, that you use in your arms and legs for that sport. But yet you do jiu-jitsu and you have one arm.
Yeah.
What's the attraction to that sport, and how have you managed to evolve your progression with one arm?
The attraction to it is that I can do it and progress in it based on hard work. It's not a sympathy thing, because it's such an adaptive sport. And the more I train, the more I read, the more I watch other people, the more I understand that even if you have got both arms and both legs, although there may be set ways to do things, everyone's got a little tweak and an adaption that they do that suits them. Do you know what I mean? I mean, even able-bodied people, they walk around carrying injuries. So they may not be able to do a certain thing because it might tweak their knee or their back or whatever. So they'll adapt it. Now, my situation's a bit more extreme, but everything in that sport is adaptable. And I can row with other disabled people or able-bodied people and genuinely get stuck in based on hard work and trying to figure out this game of human chess. Do you know what I mean? Like, I had people before offer me, because I did martial arts before I was injured, people offered to get me black belts in things like karate, and I think it was taekwondo as well. And I just know it's not possible, because I don't have legs. I've only got one arm. I can't do what's required legitimately to progress through the ranks in those sports. So it would have been based on sympathy, you know, and oh, look at the little man with no legs. He's trying his best. Let's give him a belt, you know. But in this jiu-jitsu thing, people kick my ass. Like, they're not scared. I broke my femur about 2 years ago, didn't I? Someone slammed me on my femur bone and broke my leg. I've only got about 8 inches of it left, and they snapped an inch off the end of it. But yeah, and you know what's great about it is, you know, when I got injured, my whole identity was wrapped up in physicality of being a Royal Marine, of being a warrior, of being a soldier, and then you feel it gets taken away from you. But with jiu-jitsu, you get that back, because you're doing that alpha male stuff again, that testosterone fueled stuff that lights you up and makes you feel again like a warrior. You know what I mean? Because you're fighting for survival. You're trying to stop yourself getting choked or tapped out.
How did you get involved in jiu-jitsu?
So I was in the sergeant's mess at Stonehouse Barracks, and a gentleman who you know just left the corps now, former Royal Marine, Colour Sergeant, physical training instructor, Sam Sheriff, approached me and invited me down to the combat room at Stonehouse Barracks. Now, this was after these other people had offered me, you know, to train in martial arts. So I was like, oh, here we go again. Here's another guy promising me he can do this. But because he was a bootneck, I thought I'll give him the benefit of the doubt. I'll be polite and I'll show up. And literally after that first session of grappling, it sunk straight in that I could do it based on hard work and effort and learning. And he didn't go easy on me. You know what I mean? He put me through my paces and it was horrible. I remember, I think I threw up actually because I wasn't used to rolling around and my head flicking back and everything. But I was just hooked. And I thought, I can do this. It's going to suck for a little while, but I can genuinely do this and figure this out. And I think it was about 3.5 years ago. And I've been on the train ever since.
That's class, mate. Mm. And you know, we've had a little roll around. I'm 6'5".
Yeah.
And we've had
I'm a little 3'2".
and honestly, there was, you know, at times where we were rolling, I'm thinking, that's out of order. He's got no legs because I can't like grip hold of certain things and stuff. So, you know, there is a little bit of swings and roundabouts. You know,
yeah, it's advantages to be
in fairness, mate. I'd still have you even if you did have your arms and legs. So,
yeah, all right. We'll let you have that one.
So, mate, I think it'd be sort of remiss not to talk about your recent exploits as well with Real Charity. Mm-hmm. And I know that we said that the charity doesn't define you, and that's something that you want to, you know, start moving it. You're in promoting more of your identity and the some of the background work you've been doing.
Mm-hmm.
But the recent activities that you've been doing for Real Charity has been pretty incredible, to say the least. So you want to explain a little bit about the run and the swim that you decided that probably you just sat there and went to Sam, oh, I think, yeah, we should do this. And then that was how it sort of fag packet idea turned into reality.
Right, I'll tell you what happened. So REORG became an official charity in October last year. And I was planning on putting my chit in. I was working for the Royal Marines charity at the time. And I was reaching my 10-year point. And, you know, my kids are getting older and things were getting a little bit more difficult. And I just decided that it was time for me to step back. You know, all that stuff I was talking about, the background stuff, I thought I want to concentrate on this now because it was all a bit messy and I needed just the freedom to smooth everything out and cement that foundation and keep building. So I put my chit in to leave. And I thought, well, because they're so new, this charity, what I'll do is I'll shave my beard off. I'll do a Facebook Live thing and I'll try and get £1,000. It wasn't about the money. It was about the attention on the website so people could see it, know what it was about and raise some awareness. So my little daughter, Evelyn, my youngest one, she shaved my beard on the live stream and she's sassy and cute and she's really good on camera. She doesn't care and everyone loved it. And we did like £1,000 in maybe 32 hours. So if I remember rightly, I think it was actually Ben Wadham, who was another former Royal Marines PTI, who said, look, you know, you've got this momentum now. Why don't we do something else? And so then we thought, okay. And I know this wasn't my idea because I detest running. So Ben must've said to me, When you get to £5,000, let's run 5,000 meters. So 5K for 5K. And I'm like, right, okay. I detest running. I don't even know where my running legs were. I found them in my garage. They'd been there about 3 years underneath a cupboard, covered in cobwebs. So we dusted them off. And because of COVID, we had to go down to a park in Plymouth called Victoria Park, which has a 1.2 kilometer circular route. So I couldn't get my legs adjusted or anything because all the prosthetic sensors were locked. But I just thought, okay, we'll go down, we'll get a baseline. So he made me run 2.5K in that first day.
He is a bit of a dick though, ain't he, Ben?
You know, in that way, yes.
In an endearing way.
In a nice way, yeah. But we got like 200 meters from the end. And I was tired and, you know, my concentration was lacking. And you have to concentrate a lot when you're an above knee amputee. And the sole of the leg had worn off. So it was carbon fiber on tarmac, which is like ice. So I hit the deck. I do the front splits. I knock the wind out myself. We catch it all on camera. But I'm like 200 minutes in the end. So I'm like, right, I'm just going to get up and finish up. It's not going to be pretty. My leg was falling off, but we did it. And the video went viral. And I think it's at like 6.8 million hits right now. But then all the mainstream media started calling. So I did these interviews and literally I was sat here where I am now. And I said, look, when we get to 5,000 pounds, I'm going to run 5 kilometers. Not, I don't know if I'm just dumb and I don't understand the concept of how far 5K is or what, but it didn't seem that much to me. By the time I'd walked from here in my garage to my front room, I had, I think, 800 emails, which were notifications saying people have donated to your page. And over that weekend, it went from, I think, 3,000 to 69 grand or something ridiculous, which is great. But we'd done one training session. I'd booked in 8 weeks to get my fitness up and get my legs adjusted to do it. And I said, on telly, when we get to 5K, I'm going to run 5K. So 3 minutes after the interview, I'm like, great. Now I've got to do it. So we literally went back to that park a couple of days later, did one more run, called up Tavistock Athletic Club, set the date, and about 3 or 4 days later, went down and had to knock out 5K with two training sessions, no cardio, legs that didn't fit properly. They weren't adjusted or aligned properly. They were a mess. Do you know what I mean? It's like, I guess, running speed marching with webbing that's slack and a weapon that's banging around everywhere. It was just, it wasn't optimal. And I dragged myself through it and it was awful. But then when we got to the end, every time I ran a lap, John Maguire from the BBC kept on shouting out the new total because they live streamed the whole thing. And it was going up and up and up. And it ended up at 160 grand. So then we're like, oh, we've got all this momentum now. The BBC are on board with this. Social media is going crazy. So then Ben wants to sit down and talk about doing a swim. Now, I hadn't swam in the sea since I was about 13 years old. And I'll very quickly explain swimming as a triple amputee. I used to be a good swimmer. Right? When I had all my arms and legs, I was a strong swimmer. When I lost my legs, the first time I swam in the pool, I got to the middle, ran out of breath, breathed out and sank. And I just managed to get enough air in my lungs to keep me buoyant, dragged myself to the side and then didn't swim for about 4 years. And I didn't realize that now that I was missing three limbs, you have to have air in your lungs to stay afloat. But that situation scared me, so I didn't swim. I eventually relearned that and figured out how to swim and how much air I needed in my lungs to do whatever, figured out the different strokes. Then we got in the sea and I had the complete opposite problem. Now the problem was that with seawater and a wetsuit, I'm too buoyant. So now I'm fighting to get under the water. So we had to relearn how to swim again for the third time in my life. And this time we had a few more training sessions. I think we had 5 in total, getting in the sea, swimming out. I think our last training session was about a 750 meter day. And then the other week we set off from Drake's Island. We actually did 1100 meters because we got caught in the current and it dragged us downstream a little bit. So we had to put a little bit more in. But yeah, we did a 1 kilometer open water sea swim, which has taken the total to £454,000. And tomorrow we start training for the 100 mile bike ride from North Devon back to Plymouth. Again, Ben's idea. I just
he mentioned that to me the other day, actually. I texted him just about other stuff. Yeah. He says, he mentioned that, which I was like,
this is how well prepared we are for these things, right? We've got a 100 mile bike ride coming up. And today I sent an email because Ben hasn't got a bike. This is how well prepared these are. He hasn't got a bike, but suggested we do a 100 mile bike ride. I'm like, what are you going to do on hopes and dreams? I mean, we need a bike, mate.
But this is coming from a bloke that has set a hugely successful gym up during a global pandemic when gyms are shut. So everyone else who's got a gym, they close it down because they've been told they have to. Not Ben. Now, Ben's like, I'm going to open one.
Yeah, from scratch.
Yeah, from absolute nothing. So during this global pandemic, when everything's shut, I'm opening one. He's something else, and he's brilliant.
He didn't just open a gym. He had to renovate an entire building, right? An old school, like two-story, I think it was a church back in the day, renovate an entire building, then open a gym. So, you know, during the lockdown, and he's just had another baby.
He's a great lad.
Ethic, mate.
He's a great lad.
Yeah.
Mate, that's you know, there's some, we have literally covered wave tops in your journey to date, but I'm fully aware that, you know, this has been spoken about time and time again. So, and I appreciate your time, mate. I really do. I know it's precious to you. And I know that this is obviously evening times, family time as well. So, you know, make no mistake, I value your support in what I'm trying to do in my own little way. And and for some of the other shows that I've done, I know it makes a difference to people that listen in, and it does inspire people, which is nice for me to receive those messages. So,
yeah,
mate, like, you know this, if I can be of any help at all with what you're doing moving forward, and I won't be pulling your pants down, just drop in sight
again,
anyway.
Again.
But you know, just give me a shout, mate, and I'm there for you, pal.
Thank you, mate. And same to you, mate. If I can do anything to support what you're doing going forward, just let me know.
Yeah, nice one, bro.
If you like what you hear, don't forget to subscribe to the podcast channel for updates on new releases. And why not leave a review on your podcast provider and follow us on Instagram on the @CantCanWill page to show your support. Thanks, legends.